Chapter 7. The young man accompanying the general was about 28, tall and well-built, with a fine and intelligent face and a humorous and mocking look in his big shining black eyes. Aglaé did not even look round at him. She went on reciting the verses, still affecting to look at no one but Mushkin and addressing him only. He realized that she was doing it all with some object, but the new arrivals did, at any rate, somewhat lessen the awkwardness of his position. Seeing them, he stood up, nodded cordially to the general from a distance, signed to them not to interrupt the recitation, and succeeded in retreating behind his armchair. Then, leaning with his arm on the back of it, he was able to listen to the ballad in a more convenient and less absurd position than before. Lizaveta Prokofievna, for her part, motioned twice peremptorily to the visitors to stand still. Mushkin was much interested in his new visitor, the young man who was with General Epanchin. He knew he must be Yevgeny Pavlovich Radomsky, of whom he had heard a good deal already, and thought more than once. He was only perplexed at his civilian dress. He had heard that Yevgeny Pavlovich was a military man. A mocking smile played about the young man's lips all the time the poem was being recited, as though he too had heard something about the poor knight. Perhaps it was his idea, thought Mushkin to himself. But it was quite different with Aglaé. The affectation and pompousness with which she began the recitation was replaced by earnestness and a deep consciousness of the spirit and meaning of the poem. She spoke the lines with such noble simplicity that by the end of the recitation she not only held the attention of all, but, by her interpretation of the lofty spirit of the ballad, she had, as it were, to some extent justified the exaggerated affected gravity with which she had so solemnly stepped into the middle of the veranda. That gravity might now be taken to have been only due to the depth, and perhaps even simplicity, of her respect for the poem she had undertaken to interpret. Her eyes shone, and a faint, scarcely perceptible shiver of inspiration and ecstasy passed twice over her handsome face. She recited, "Lived a knight once, poor and simple, pale of face with glance austere, spare of speech, but with a spirit proud, intolerant of fear. He had had a wondrous vision, ne'er could feeble human art gauge its deep, mysterious meaning. It was graven on his heart, and since then his soul had quivered with an all-consuming fire. Nevermore he looked on women, speech with them did not desire. But he dropped his scarf thenceforward, wore a chaplet in its place, and no more in sight of any raised the visor from his face. Filled with purest love and fervour, faith which his sweet dream did yield, in his blood he traced the letters NFB upon his shield. When the paladins, proclaiming ladies' names as true love's sign, hurled themselves into the battle on the plains of Palestine, Lumen coli sancta rosa, shouted he with flaming glance, and the fury of his menace checked the Mussulman's advance. Then, returning to his castle in far distant countryside, silent, sad, bereft of reason, in his solitude he died." Recalling that moment later, Mushkin was long after greatly perplexed and tormented by a question to which he could find no answer. How could such a genuine and noble feeling be associated with such unmistakable malice and mockery? Of the existence of the mockery he had no doubt. He understood that clearly, and had grounds for it. In the course of the recitation, Aglaé had taken the liberty of changing the letters AMD into NFB. That he had not misunderstood or misheard this, he could have no doubt. It was proved to him afterwards. In any case, Aglaé's performance, a joke, of course, though too ruthless and thoughtless, was premeditated. Everyone had been talking and laughing about the poor knight for the last month, and yet, as Mushkin recalled afterwards, Aglaé had pronounced those letters without any trace of jest or sneer, without indeed any special emphasis on those letters to suggest their hidden significance. On the contrary, she had uttered those letters with such unchanged gravity, with such innocent and naive simplicity, that one might have supposed that those very letters were in the ballad and printed in the book. Mushkin felt a pang of discomfort and depression. Lizaveta Prokofievna, of course, did not notice or understand the change in the letters, nor the allusion in it. General Epanchin understood nothing more than that a poem was being recited. Many of the other listeners understood and were surprised at the boldness of the performance, and also at the motive underlying it, but they were silent and tried to conceal it. But Mushkin was ready to wager that Yevgeny Pavlovich had not only understood, but was even trying to show he had understood. He smiled with too mocking an air. "How splendid!" cried Madame Epanchin in genuine enthusiasm, as soon as the recitation was over. "Whose poem is it?" "Pushkin's, maman. Don't put us to shame. It's disgraceful," cried Adelaida. "It's a wonder I'm no sillier with such daughters," Lizaveta Prokofievna responded bitterly. "It's a disgrace. Give me that poem of Pushkin's as soon as we get home." "But I don't believe we've got a Pushkin. There have been two untidy volumes lying about ever since I can remember," added Alexandra. "We must send someone, Fyodor or Alexei, by the first train to town to buy one. Alexei would be best. Aglaya, come here. Kiss me. You recited it splendidly. But if you recited it sincerely," she added almost in a whisper, "I am sorry for you. If you did it to make fun of him, I can't help blaming your feelings, so that in any case it would have been better not to recite it at all. Do you understand? Go along, miss. I shall have something to say to you presently. We've stayed too long." Meanwhile, Mushkin greeted General Epanchin, and the general was introducing Yevgeny Pavlovich Radomsky to him.
"I picked him up on the way here. He was coming from the station. He heard that I was coming here, and all the rest were here."
"Now, I heard that you were here, too," Yevgeny Pavlovich interrupted. "And as I had long meant to try and gain not only your acquaintance but your friendship, I didn't want to lose time. You are unwell. I've only just heard."
"I'm perfectly well, and very glad to make your acquaintance. I've heard a great deal about you, and even talked about you to Prince S., answered Mushkin, holding out his hand.
Mutual courtesies were exchanged. They pressed each other's hands and looked intently into each other's eyes. At once the conversation became general. Mushkin noticed, and he was noticing everything now, rapidly and eagerly, and possibly noticed what was not there at all, that Yevgeny Pavlovich's civilian dress excited general and very marked surprise, so much so that for a time all other impressions were effaced and forgotten. It might be conjectured that this change implied something of great consequence. Adelaida and Alexandra questioned Yevgeny Pavlovich in perplexity. Prince S., his relation, even with great uneasiness, and General Epanchin spoke almost with emotion. Aglaya was the only one who looked with perfect composure, though with curiosity, at Yevgeny Pavlovich for a moment, as though she were simply trying to decide whether the civilian dress or the military suited him best. But a minute later she turned away and did not look at him again. Lizaveta Prokofievna, too, did not care to ask any questions, though perhaps she, too, was rather uneasy. Mushkin fancied that Yevgeny Pavlovich was not in her good books.
"He has surprised me, amazed me," Ivan Fyodorovich repeated in answer to all inquiries. "I wouldn't believe him when I met him a little while ago in Petersburg. And why so suddenly? That's the puzzle. He's always saying himself there's no need to break the furniture."
From the conversation that followed, it appeared that Yevgeny Pavlovich had long ago announced his intention of resigning his commission, but had always spoken of it so flippantly that it had been impossible to take his words seriously. He always talked, indeed, with such a jesting air of serious things that it was impossible to make him out, especially if he didn't want to be made out.
"It's only for a time, for some months, a year at most, that I shall be on the retired list," laughed Radomsky.
"But there is no need of it whatever, as far as I understand your position, at least," General Epanchin kept urging hotly.
"But to visit my estates? You advised it yourself. Besides, I want to go abroad."
But the subject was soon changed, though the over-prominent and still persistent uneasiness seemed excessive to Mushkin, as he watched it, and he divined that there was some special reason for it.
"So the poor knight is on the scene again," Yevgeny Pavlovich queried, approaching Aglaya.
To Mushkin's surprise, she looked at him perplexed and questioning, as though to give him to understand that the poor knight was a subject which she could not possibly touch upon with him, and that she did not even comprehend his question.
"But it's too late. Too late to send to town for a copy of Pushkin tonight. It's too late,"
Kolya maintained, in exasperation to Lizaveta Prokofievna.
"I've told you 3,000 times it's too late."
Yes, it really is too late to send to town now. Yevgeny Pavlovich intervened here too, hurriedly leaving Aglaya.
"I believe the shops are shut by now in Petersburg. It's past 8,
he declared, looking at his watch.
"Since you've waited so long without missing it, you can wait till tomorrow,"
put in Adelaida.
"And it's not the thing for people of the best society to be too much interested in literature," added Kolya. "Ask Yevgeny Pavlovich. It's more correct to be keen on a yellow sharabank with red wheels."
"You are talking in quotations again, Kolya," observed Adelaida.
"But he never speaks except in quotations," chimed in Yevgeny Pavlovich. "He takes whole phrases out of the reviews. I've long had the pleasure of knowing Nikolai Ardalionovich's conversation, but this time he is not talking in quotations. Nikolai Ardalionovich is plainly alluding to my yellow sharabank with red wheels, but I've exchanged it. You're behind the times."
Mushkin listened to what Radomsky was saying. He thought that his manners were excellent, modest and lively, and he was particularly pleased to hear him reply with perfect equality and friendliness to the jibes of Kolya.
"What is it?" asked Lizaveta Prokofievna, addressing Vera, Lebediev's daughter, who was standing before her with some large, almost new and finely bound volumes in her hands.
"Pushkin," said Vera. "Our Pushkin. Father told me to offer it to you."
"How is this? How can it be?" cried Lizaveta Prokofievna in surprise. "Not as a present, not as a present. I wouldn't take the liberty."
Lebediev skipped forward from behind his daughter.
"At cost price. This is our own Pushkin, handed down in the family. An Enkhoff's edition, which cannot be bought nowadays. At cost price. I offer it with veneration, wishing to sell it, and so to satisfy the honourable impatience of your Excellency's most honourable literary feelings."
"Well, if you'll sell it, thank you. You won't be a loser by it, you may be sure. Only don't play the fool, please, sir. I've heard that you are very well read. We'll have a talk one day. Will you bring them yourself?"
"With veneration and respectfulness,"
Lebediev grimaced with extraordinary satisfaction, taking the books from his daughter.
"Well, mind you don't lose them. Take them, even without respectfulness, but only on condition," she added, scanning him carefully, "that I only admit you to the door, and don't intend to receive you today. Send your daughter Vera at once, if you will. I like her very much."
"Why don't you tell him about those people?"
said Vera, addressing her father impatiently.
"They'll come in of themselves if you don't. They've begun to be noisy. Lyov Nikolaevich," she said, addressing Mushkin, who had already taken his hat, "there are 4 men come to see you. They've been waiting a long time, scolding, but father won't let them into you."
"Who are they?" asked Mushkin.
"They've come on business, they say. Only if you don't let them in now, they'll be sure to stop you on the way. You'd better see them, Lyov Nikolaevich, and then you'll be rid of them. Gavril Ardalionovich and Titsin are talking to them, but they won't listen to them."
"The son of Pavlishchov! The son of Pavlishchov! They're not worth it, they're not worth it,"
said Lebediev, waving his hands.
"They're not worth listening to, and it would be out of place for you to disturb yourself on their account, most illustrious prince. They're not worth it."
"The son of Pavlishchov? Good heavens,"
cried Mushkin, extremely disconcerted.
"I know, but, you see, I asked Gavril Ardalionovich to attend to that. Gavril Ardalionovich told me just now—"
But Gavril Ardalionovich had already come out of the house onto the veranda. Titsin followed him. In the next room there were sounds of uproar and the loud voice of General Ivolgin, who seemed to be trying to shout down several others. Kolya ran indoors at once.
"This is very interesting," observed Yevgeny Pavlovich aloud.
"So he knows about it," thought Mushkin.
"What son of Pavlishchov? And what son of Pavlishchov can there be?"
General Epanchin asked in amazement, looking at everyone with curiosity, and observing with surprise from their faces that he was the only one who knew nothing about this new development. The excitement and expectation was general indeed. Mushkin was profoundly astonished that such an entirely personal affair could already have roused so much interest in everyone here.
"It would be a very good thing if you put a stop to this at once, and yourself," said Aglaia, going up to Mushkin with particular earnestness, "and allow us all to be your witnesses. They are trying to throw mud at you, Prince. You must defend yourself triumphantly, and I am awfully glad for you."
"I want this disgusting claim to be stopped at last, too," cried Madame Epanchin. "Give it to them well, Prince. Don't spare them. My ears have been tingling with this business, and it's been spoiling my temper on your account. Besides, it will be interesting to look at them. Call them in, and we'll sit down. It's a good idea of Aglaia's. You've heard something about it, Prince," she added, addressing Prince S.
"Of course I have, in your house. But I'm particularly anxious to have a look at these young people," answered Prince S.
"These are what are meant by nihilists, aren't they?"
No, they are not to say nihilists," said Lebediev, stepping forward and almost shaking with excitement. "They are different, a special sort. My nephew tells me they have gone far beyond the nihilists. You are wrong if you think you'll abash them by your presence, Your Excellency. They won't be abashed. Nihilists are sometimes well-informed people anyway, even learned. But these have gone further, because they are first of all men of business. This is a sort of sequel to nihilism, not in a direct line, but obliquely, by hearsay, and they don't express themselves in newspaper articles, but directly, in action. It's not a question of the irrationality of Pushkin, or someone, for instance, nor the necessity of the breaking up of Russia into parts. No, now they claim, as a right, that if one wants anything very much, one is not to be checked by any obstacles, even though one might have to do for half a dozen people to gain one's ends. But all the same, Prince, I should not advise you—"
But Pushkin had already gone to open the door to the visitors.
"You are slandering them, Lebediev," he said, smiling. "Your nephew has hurt your feelings very much. Don't believe him, Lizaveta Prokofievna. I assure you that Gorsky's and Danilov's are only exceptions, and these are only mistaken. But I should have preferred not to see them here, before everyone. Excuse me, Lizaveta Prokofievna. They'll come in. I'll show them to you and then take them away. Come in, gentlemen."
He was more worried by another painful thought. He wondered, had not someone arranged this business beforehand for that time, for that hour, in the presence of those witnesses, and perhaps in anticipation of his shame rather than his triumph? But he felt too sad at the thought of his monstrous and wicked suspiciousness. He felt that he would have died if anyone had known he had such an idea in his head. And at the moment when his guests walked in, he was genuinely ready to believe that he was lower, in a moral sense, than the lowest around him. Five persons entered, four new arrivals, followed by General Ivolgin, in a state of heated agitation and violent loquacity.
"He is on my side, no doubt," thought Mushkin with a smile.
Kolya slipped in among them. He was talking hotly to Ippolit, who was one of the visitors. Ippolit listened, grinning. Mushkin made his visitors sit down. They all looked so young, hardly grown up indeed, that their visit and the attention paid them seemed strange. Ivan Fyodorovich, for instance, who knew nothing about this new development and could not make it out, was quite indignant at the sight of their youthfulness, and would certainly have made some sort of protest had he not been checked by his wife's unaccountable eagerness on behalf of Mushkin's private affairs. He remained, however, partly out of curiosity and partly from kind-heartedness, hoping to help, or at least to be of use, by the exercise of his authority. But General Ivolgin's bow to him from the distance roused his indignation again. He frowned and made up his mind to be consistently silent. Of the four young men who came in, one, however, was a man of 30, the retired lieutenant, who had been one of Rogozhin's crew, the boxer, who had in his time given as much as 15 rubles each to beggars. It could be guessed that he had come to stand by the others as a faithful friend, and, if necessity arose, to support them. The foremost and most prominent of the others was the young man to whom the designation the son of Pavlishchov had been given, though he introduced himself as Antip Badovsky. He was a young man, poorly and untidily dressed. The sleeves of his coat shone like a mirror. His greasy waistcoat was buttoned up to the neck. His linen had disappeared entirely. His incredibly dirty black silk scarf was twisted like a rope. His hands were unwashed. He was fair,
and his face, which was covered with pimples, had, if one may so express it, an air of innocent insolence. He was about 22, thin and not short. There was not a trace of irony or introspection in his face, nothing but a complete blank conviction of his own rights, and, at the same time, something like a strange and incessant craving to be and feel insulted. He spoke with excitement, hurrying and stuttering, hardly articulating the words, as though he had an impediment in his speech, or even were a foreigner, though he was, as a fact, entirely Russian by birth. He was accompanied first by Lebediev's nephew, already known to the reader, and secondly by Ippolit. The latter was a very young man, 17 or possibly 18, with an intelligent but always irritable expression, and terrible signs of illness in his face. He was thin as a skeleton, pale and yellow. His eyes gleamed, and two hectic spots glowed on his cheeks. He coughed incessantly. Every word, almost every breath, was followed by gasping. He was evidently in the last stage of consumption. He looked as though he could scarcely live for more than another 2 or 3 weeks. He was very tired, and before anyone else he sank into a chair. The other visitors were rather ceremonious, and even a little embarrassed on entering. They had an important air, however, and were obviously afraid of failing to keep up their dignity in some way, which was strangely out of harmony with their reputation for despising all useless worldly trivialities, conventions, and almost everything in the world except their own interests.
"Antipodovsky," said the son of Pavlishchov, in a hurried stutter. "Vladimir Doktorenko," Lebediev's nephew introduced himself clearly, distinctly, as though boasting of the fact that his name was Doktorenko.
"Keller," muttered the retired lieutenant.
"Ippolit Terentyev,"
squeaked the last of the party, in an unexpectedly shrill voice. All of them were sitting at last on chairs facing Mushkin. They had all introduced themselves, frowned and shifted their caps from one hand to the other to keep themselves in countenance. All of them seemed on the point of speaking, but remained silent, waiting for something with a defiant air, which seemed to say, "No, my friend, you are wrong there. You won't take us in." One felt that someone had only to utter one word to start them, and they would all begin talking at once, interrupting and tripping each other up.